Okay, you don't need it at the very beginning. Okay, Ron Dethelson has published two of the most beautiful books that has come out about the phonograph in recent years. The two books about the Edison Blue Ampérol records. Here's a little warning, folks. The first book is out of print. There are only 500 copies, and there are 500 happy owners and probably several hundred unhappy non-owners around there. The used value of that book is now...
55 clackers.
That's over twice what the original cost was. There are 80 copies left of Volume 2. May I make a suggestion? If you don't have that book, get it now. Ron is a teacher of speech and communications, and he is professor of communication at Bakersfield College and advisor to the college FM station. He's collected records and phonographs since 1954 and has written numerous articles as well as the two books. And he is presently engaged in amassing material relating to the Edison Company's records and machines through the full period of 1910 through 1929. And this is libel, the material in today's presentation about the Edison disc labels. The original title had said diamond disc, but of course there's going to be more than just the diamond discs talked about here. Will probably be a chapter in the forthcoming book, and Ron will also be publishing later this year Ray Weil's book on the Edison disc matrix series. So here now, while they're still setting up their projectors, is Ron Dethelson.
Thank you. I'll try to edit a little bit as we go along, because I know you all want to get to lunch at a famous San Francisco bistro nearby, probably. We'll move right along. Could we have that first copy on the machine? This is probably the first representation, pictorial representation of the Edison label, this diamond disc label. This is on the patent application of Jonas Aylesworth in 1912, June of 1912. You notice Edison is right on the label, and he never left the label in all the years that the company produced disc records. Also, notice that there is a record number on the label, which was, by the way, put on several experimental labels, but again, it never reached the marketplace. And the title is there, of course. And then the circular format sort of an oblong format for the label design is there. And these basic pieces remain the same all the way through 1929 and then the last of the diamond discs. But this is the beginning. Also at the top, you see the way the electrotype was applied to the master wax, and then this separately created electrotype label was bonded to the master wax with beeswax and paraffin. Then the whole thing was plated after being rendered electrically conductive with graphite, with powdered graphite. And then the whole thing was immersed in plating baths, and that way the final stamper or working mold was made. This is Jonas Aylesworth's patent. It was updated a number of different times during the 1910s, but this basically is what it all stemmed from. And the idea was to produce a label which wouldn't be able to curl up and blow away. It could be scraped off. It was an integral part of the record. Several other record companies had done this. As you probably know, the Berliner Records had labels that were an integral part of the record. And Little Wonder, and of course Pathé produced records that were a part of the label. But they were more or less engraved or etched right into the label at the time, shortly after the time the record was made. Edison's was electrotype applied after the master was made and then plated as one complete unit. And it was probably a pretty good idea, but there were some problems that developed. I suppose the thing is to start at the beginning. We don't know exactly when it all started, when the labels began to be made, indeed when the records began to be made. Probably it was sometime around early 1912 that he finally took his matrices that he'd been recording since January 1910 and began making actual pressings from them. The matrices, as you'll see later on, I will be showing some slides to illustrate this beginning overview I'm giving. You'll see those matrices, and you'll see that they're cut quite early, and indeed, some of them never were processed. But around the beginning of 1912, he began pressing experimental labels, and finally derived a shield pattern for the label. Let us do away with that, and then you go ahead and set up the slide projector, which we'll use here in about 10 minutes. Now, lights, please. Somewhere? Thank you. The first record label was a shield pattern, and Edison put A and B for the side definition on the label. Later he was to go to R and L, which meant right and left, but the beginning labels had numbers on them, right on the face of the label, and the A and B configuration. And this ceased being done in experimental pressings about June 1912, just about the time this Aylesworth patent was applied for. And then these labels, as I said, were etched or photo-engraved, and the early labels had a 400-line per inch pattern in the background. And this made the label very readable. If you've been familiar with Edison diamond discs, probably you're most familiar with later copies of the etched label, which are very hard to read, almost like a tintype. You have to hold it to the light. The first ones were not that way, as you'll see here shortly, due to this 400-line etched background. They were very readable and rather rich looking. Colored labels were also tried. Aylesworth, in his notes in the document filed for 1911 at the Edison site, states that they had no problem introducing color filler into debossed labels with indented printing. The only problem was the excess coloring matter had to be buffed off the label. And so the colored labels never came on the market, maybe due to the extra hand steps of applying the pigmentation and having to buff away the excess. Maybe it was a cost factor that kept them from producing colored labels. But in this 1911 memo, Aylesworth himself feels that the gray 400-line per inch labels are much richer, and evidently Edison agrees because, as you know, Edison oversaw every last detail of record production, particularly in the diamond disc era, almost down to the very end of 1929. So labor considerations maybe were important in choosing the etched labels over colored labels, the gray etched labels. And then, of course, the basic primary fact in choosing these etched labels, as I said before, was the idea that ordinary paper labels could peel off, but also in the pressing process of Edison's manufacturing of diamond disc records, the pressing process was extremely long. I've never found any figures for exactly how long it took to press a diamond disc, but Ray has a figure. Okay, I was going to say between 10 and 20, and supposedly the longer the better is what we've found out in some of the factory notes. So, of course, a paper label tended to burn up or become badly charred if it was applied at the same time as the blank went into the press. So this kept paper labels off the market for a while. In 1921, as you'll see, it was finally found to use a sub-label that became charred in the pressing, and then the real label was pasted on top of the sub-label when it was when it was done, and that seemed to work. Although we still know that the paper labels do come off, as you've probably seen in some of your collections. Then several variations of labels occur. We've noted about 20 different variations in the diamond disc label. And all of these will be shown in our forthcoming book that Ray and I are putting out. We hope to be off the presses in November on that. The disc continued along fairly regularly, successful in production, until about 1916, when a big change happened. And this was the elimination of the transfer process. The discs were originally pressed with a celluloid overlay, and then the celluloid overlay was bonded to a wood flour filler with an asphaltic type binder. That process led to rim splits and peeling away due to humidity of the record celluloid overlay. It was tried, the improvement that was tried was applying the condensite or plastic varnish that Edison and Aylesworth had developed, applying it directly to the wood flour blank, without having a celluloid overlay. This was somewhat successful in reducing the amount of rim splits, but it also gave a very rough surface to the record. However, it was sort of a trade-off, and Edison evidently felt that the rougher surface was desirable compared to all the problems they were having with the rim splits. So in 1916, then, the transfer process ended, and I'm sure if any of you have diamond discs in your collection, you know that starting around that period, you have very noisy diamond discs. If you've heard any of the earlier ones made by the transfer process, chances are they may be some of your favorites because the surface is so quiet. The transfer surface process resulted in the quietest surfaces until the mid-1920s when, as you'll see, some improvements were made in the production process, and the diamond discs again become quite quiet and better in quality all the way around. They were also constantly checking and trying to improve the discs in other ways. In 1915, a gripper mark was used on the record. If you look in your collection in about the 50,200 mark, you may find at quarter hour marks on the diamond disc little indentations in the rim of the record, but like you might make with your fingernail. These were bonding marks. Some sort of a technique was worked out, and these records were crimped in order to hold the edge of the record down. It was a way of trying to prevent those rim splits, so it may not have been very successful since the gripper marks do not seem to exist on very many copies of diamond discs that I've seen. But it was a way of helping things out. They were constantly working with torture tests to see how good the disc would stand up in moist conditions. The best they were ever able to do was 10 minutes underwater for a diamond disc. At that point, the diamond disc always split. But they were constantly testing, constantly checking, trying to get the things right. They had all kinds of problems with this, as you may be aware of. About 3 coats of varnish was the average application. It was first done with a brush. Aylesworth, in his 1911 notes, finds this is really unacceptable. It produces air bubbles and the contamination due to dust on the brush. And he suggests a rotating dipping process where the record was sort of dunked continuously, or I should say the blank was dunked continuously and coated with the condensite, and then separated from the solution, and then it was put in a drying, or should we say eventually a varnishing machine was doing all this. A lot of handwork in the beginning, eventually sometime probably around 1916, as the diamond disc really begins to take off in popularity, a varnishing machine was put into operation. If any of you have George Frau's book, there's a picture of the varnishing machine on page 228. It's sort of a roller coaster machine. The record is varnished and then goes up on a rack. Individual records are slipped in these racks, goes up to the top of the machine, looks like from the picture about 6 or 8 feet in the air, goes over the top of the machine and then back down where it's varnished again, and then up go on the roller coaster up to the top and back down again. About 3 of these stations appear to be used in the photographs that I've seen. What was happening in this up and down motion was the disc was drying, and we don't know exactly I've never seen the exact time it took to varnish a disc, but it wasn't a quick process. They tried fans blowing air on the record as it went up this roller coaster effect. They found that the records, the condensite varnish, tended to skin over if it was dried by forced draft. They found they simply had to let the thing dry on its own power. And they tried mixing extra solvent into the record, but the diamond disc was a very slowly produced item. And this is one of the problems in marketing it. They never could get enough to the market, particularly in the years around 1920 when it was extremely popular. And dealers were always crying for more product at that time. They never were able, it seems, to speed up the process when the records were in great demand to satisfy the marketplace. Sounds like some of the remarks Ray was mentioning about the doll. It seems to go all through Edison's production history. Anyway, the varnish was applied eventually by machines. And then there were also problems with the wood flour blanks. The wood flour was never ground, in some cases, fine enough. Or, as Theodore Edison told me recently, they got one batch of wood flour that was in recycled burlap sugar bags, and there was enough residual sugar in the bag to make the records literally granular in nature when they applied the condensite varnish over the flower blanks. Also, they had a problem with dust. March 15, 1925, a report of one of the inspectors, again in the document files at the Edison site, states that workmen should stop sweeping up near truckloads of varnished blanks, because the dust, of course, was falling on the blanks. And it said, we only give the records one swipe with a feather duster before we put them into the presses. Hence, dust did accumulate. Theodore Edison also told me that they had a problem with the feather dusters. They used ostrich feathers, and they found that a bunch of feathers came from birds that had dandruff. And of course, then the records also turned out granular in nature. So there are some unusual bird disease, anyway, that caused the dusters to be flaky. So they had this type of problem. Again, in making the powder blanks, they had blowouts, and when you think of an Edison pressing process, think of making waffles on Sunday morning or wherever you make them, because that's exactly about what Edison was doing. It took approximately about time to make a waffle as it does to make an Edison pressing. And then, as you know, the waffle mixture, if you put too much in, oozes out from the edge of the waffle iron. This happened with their powder blanks. They'd have these ooze or fins that came out from the edge of the powder blanks. Then when they put them down finally to grinding off this edge at the end of the pressing process, the thing would fly apart because you had all these fins on the edge of the record. The records were not naturally this smooth. They were ground down at the very end. They tried to make a tighter mold, but this made the interior of the record raw or uncooked. So they finally just had to depend on a certain number of records flying apart every time they tried to grind them down, and they never were able to lick that problem. There's always some loss in the production process. So all these things kept happening. They had great success, though, with filtered air. They stopped using outside air for many of the factory buildings and began using filtered air, and this cut down the dust contamination and also improved the quality of the records, particularly after 1920. Then we have in 1921, regarding record labels, the big breakthrough of paper labels, and this was a disaster for the company because of the black label problem. This is the black label record, which you're familiar with. When the paper labels came out, basically the public didn't want to buy the black labels anymore because they thought of them as outmoded products. The Edison company may have contributed to that. They tended to tell people that the white label records were vastly improved over the black label, when in the beginning they really weren't. It was pretty much the same record, but they just had a paper label on them. But still, people tended not want to buy them. The dealers were very upset, since they were caught on hand with thousands of these black label records, which suddenly were not saleable. Dealers protested. Edison Company finally gave each dealer 40 cents credit per returned record on the purchase of new paper labeled discs. You just couldn't get 40 cents in cash. You had to buy new discs and got a discount on them. And then if you wanted to get that 40 cents, there was an elaborate process of sending back only specially selected discs that the company put on a return list. And then you had to mark the packages very carefully. You had to turn in sales slips and material shipping lists in duplicate and triplicate. And only prime mint copies of records were accepted. And so once the dealer went all through that hurdle, then he could get his 40 cents credit. And they lost a lot of dealers at this time in the early 1920s, and then some key jobbers also threw up their hands and said, what's the use, and backed out at this time. And then, ironically, Harold Anderson, executive of the company at that time, told me that when they got all the records back, the company, they broke them up in little pieces and sent them down in a big gondola car to the factory powerhouse furnace and burnt them all up. So all that went for naught. There's a picture in the glass negative files at the site showing this big gondola car with a conveyor belt and filled at the top with mint condition records that are going to the furnace. So that was a problem they had with the labels. And the white label records at the beginning were not all that better. They were improved over the years, as I mentioned, into the 1920s. But the white label records were good for three basic reasons. One, the company was delighted with them because they found that the labels were a problem, because very often they might get a good pressing but a rotten label. And so a lot of records were discarded because of poor, illegible, or wavy labels, even though the sound part of the disc was good, because different portions of the disc pressed at different pressures. So the paper labels solved the situation of rejected records, lost product because of bad labels. Also, sometimes the label artwork did not show up when they're ready to put the master wax into the plating baths. And so there were delays there where master waxes were stacking up, waiting for label photo etchings. And that was eliminated with the paper label. And also, of course, as you know, they're very readable, and the public was very glad to see that. Then also another thing in the paper label, the records started to be called recreations instead of records, and that lasted basically from about June 1921, when the paper label came on the market, until the end of 1922, when the label was totally redesigned, as you'll see here shortly, and then became Edison Record for the rest of the Diamond Disc era, down to 1929. Now, what I'd like to do is to show you a series of slides. These will be depicted in the book Ray and I are coming out with in November, plus many others. But in time consideration, we've winnowed this down. And please feel free to ask any questions if I leave some facet of the slide unanalyzed. I suppose the place to start is the beginning. Here is a slide from the Ford Museum, which I had taken last summer. They have dozens of the Edison Master waxes still in the canisters. This one happened to be unsealed, and we were able to take it out. And it is from November 1910. Here's the original record slip still at the bottom of the can, and it is a selection from Aida by Alfredo Costa and Bianca Lenzi, to European artists, and this is a London recording. The disc is a 12-inch master. This is about an inch and a half thick, and it is numbered on the side for identification as well as on the slip. It's been looked at West Orange because on the side it's marked deep chips, something to that effect, and so evidently never was processed due to some recording defect in the master itself. But this is where it all started with the master. And as I say, dozens of these exist at the Ford Museum, and maybe someday they might be processed, who knows. I believe it's 12, yes, I believe it's 12. A lot of the early ones, as you know, were 12. This is the first Edison jacket, or should we say box. This again is from the Ford Museum. They have a large number of these. And this is from 1912 is when they started producing these, through about October 1913. The exact date is uncertain, but late 1913 anyway. These were beautiful boxes. They were done in turquoise and blue. Turquoise for the 80,000 series and blue for the 82,500 series, the classical series. I'll be showing you what they did to jacket the popular series in a moment. But these are beautiful. They were flocked inside. Not in the beginning, they had just a patent label warning on the inside. Later on, they flocked them. And probably for an ordinary, non-commemorative issue type record, this was the most elaborate packaging I think any American record company has even tried for regular release products. And with the liner notes on the front, the liner notes always follow the liner notes on the blue ambrol cylinders. They seem to use the same copy on the record slips and blue ambrol cylinders, and also on the diamond disc. Next slide, please. Here's a stack of them. You can see the record numbers were stenciled. These are stenciled by hand in gold on the label, and later they figured out a machine process. But probably the reason they were done away with is basically the cost of the things. I don't know a per unit cost, but it must have been excessive, and so they went to jackets. Next, please. Here is an experimental diamond disc label, and I think you can see what I mean by the 400 line per inch etched background. it gave a nice readable label. This is the clever design, a diamond disc and a diamond design on the label. It's rather pretty, but they didn't like it. Edison didn't like it. When I say they, probably it was Edison. The record is a raised portion on the label here, which is for your catalog number, whatever you wanted to put on there as a consumer. And of course, the good old Edison didn't put the name on the label. The artist is unknown. He felt that wasn't important. The music was important. And it was basically around 1915, finally pressure from the dealers and from the public and probably from some of the artists who were unknown, didn't like their names off the labels, forced them to put the names back on. The composers always were there. I believe so. Here is the final label that you are familiar with. This was used all the way through late 1918, early 1919, and is the condensite etched label that everybody is familiar with. A number of different variations were tried. I don't know whether you can see this. We spent an hour at the Ford Museum trying to get this right, and it still didn't come out. We had three spotlights and all kinds of cameras, and if you can see sort of a pattern in here, barely, sort of a polka dot pattern, several labels were elaborately engraved with sort of engine turning or polka dots in the background. A very rich looking, but probably again for labor reasons or cost or time considerations, they weren't used. But several of these exist at the Edison site, and a number of them exist with this engine turning or polka dot crosshatch pattern at the Ford Museum. So it was toyed with for a while, but then done away with just the gray etching. Next, please. Then, as I say, they did away with the etching, and you can see the difference. Just the black background, it does something to the lettering. It just doesn't stand out right. It just doesn't have the, even though this is not quite as good a photo, it just does not have the presence that the early labels did. And for the rest of the period of the etched labels down to 1921, you have this readability problem which drove the record clerks nuts as well as the public. What is that? Oh, yes. Yes, the good old New York military band. In 1921, paper labels, Ray, maybe you found out more about this label, but this may be one of the paper labels from 1921 that they toyed with. I see. Well, it could be from the 1912 era, or it could be 10 years later. We're not quite sure. But in 1921, what is that? Yes, that is a quite an early issue. Group at recording. The 1921, they tried different color labels, thought of having different colors for classical and for popular and that type of thing. But again, maybe because of cost considerations, the plain white and black and white label was decided upon. But this is a beautiful example of something that never came to pass. Next, please. This is the paper label, the earliest paper label type. And again, readability and simplicity, it was a very effective label. Next, please. This is what happens when they tried to paste a paper label over a black label record. They tried to recycle them, evidently. Some dealers caught onto this and chewed the company out royally in various letters that it still exists today, and they stopped doing that. Also, notice when they went to the paper labels, they had to stamp a record number, catalog number, on the record face itself, so in case the label became separated from the record, you still could know what record that was. You could look it up in the catalog. But this recycling did not work. Next.
Mm-hmm. You are peeling off the indentation.
Yeah.
So that would be a different thing than this, like the old labels on the stamp. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
On the
stamp. Yeah. You find overlays like that. Here's the recreation label when it was redesigned in late 1921 when they did away with the earlier type, and again this. Pretty much lasts until 1929 with a few variations. Next, please. The Red Star records. where they attempted to pick out which would be slow sellers and hold these back, and they were denoted with a red star. Also, there was a blue star series. I have found at the Edison site a blue star on the 80,000 series. We only found one example of it. I intend to check the Ford Museum when I go there next month and see if we can find another blue star. Perhaps they had intended the classicals to be denoted as slow sellers, fast sellers, with a blue star instead of a red star, as they did with the popular. Anyway, the red star series carried through the popular series. It is found on the classical series. It is found on the foreign language series. The red star definitely cut through the whole gamut of Edison releases at this time, roughly around 1923-24, that period. It looks like it's a rubber stamp because they vary in degrees of lightness. The pad was going dry, or they tried to get a number of imprints without going back to the pad with their stamper. Yeah, it's a stamp.
You will find the same record though, some with and some without the star.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe you found them.
Something that they did after the fact, after they realized.
No, I think, as far as I understand, they tried to deduce it beforehand. Just by listening to it, they figured, this'll go, and... Yeah. Then they failed miserably on some of these. Yeah, in a sense.
The dealers couldn't return those.
That's right. They couldn't return them at all. That's right. They couldn't return them at all. They were a total loss if they ordered any of these. They were special order. Also took some delay in getting these. If the public saw it, heard it, liked it, then it took a while to get them. Again, the Edison Company used some strange business practices. This is one of the strangest. Here's another variation. The difference in this label is they added the Made in the United States, which seemed to be a thing a lot of manufacturers were doing in 1920. It has a price. Dollar per record. Again, into the electrical period, the 52,000 series. Most of those were electrical, as you recall. The thing was shortened. The price was taken off, and just Made in USA was put on. And again, this is the Diamond Disc label that continued right to the end in October 1929 when they stopped being produced. Here's one that everybody wants to get a copy of. The Greetings from the Bunch at Orange, which was a pep talk from all the sales force, including Thomas Edison himself, in 1924, when, as you know, record sales were slumping, phonograph sales were slumping, basically due to the influx of radio. People had another entertainment instrument in their home besides the phonograph. This was a nice product to put out. We don't know the exact output or how many copies were issued, but each dealer at that time could have one. And rather nice caricatures on the jacket, and a good way of reaching out to the dealers. No, and again, whether the Red Star was limited edition or whether it was just the Christmas, we don't know.
There also was an alternate take on at least one side.
Was it what?
There was an alternate take on at least one of those sides.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What is that?
An alternate take on
recording. They always record, because of the pressing process, they always recorded multiple takes, without exception. Yeah, next, please. And here's a close-up of the label, side one, or part one. By the way, if you want this record, a friend of mine who let me photograph it says it's $300, which seems to be the going price for this thing, which was given away. Okay. And here's the side that everyone likes to listen to with Edison himself. Edison says he's going to sing for us, but he's decided not to because his wife says his voice sounds like a klaxon horn, and indeed it does. At this time in his life, he's virtually stone deaf by 1924 and has difficulty in speaking. But this is a nice example of pep talk by the staff of the factory. Here's another special issue. It's faded somewhat, but it's a gold on blue diamond disc put out for the 50th anniversary of the Ediphone in 1927. This is Jones and Hare singing a song, Say It to the Ediphone, written by Art Walsh with a violin obbligato in the middle of it, also by Art Walsh. And Art Welsh got a lot of mileage out of his work there. Especially limited example of records sent just to the dealers. And we come to the long play era. Here is the jacket for the 12-inch, 40-minute long play recordings. A beautiful thing. As you'll see, it's a very elaborate, probably the most elaborate paper jacket Edison put out. Next, please. And the 40-minute label with the Edison, modernized Edison logo and script there. These, of course, were all dubbed, as you may recall, from contemporary discs. There were no live ones in the series. Here's the 40-minute label, pretty much the same, except, of course, more selections. 20 minutes per side at 80 RPM, 450 grooves to the inch, grooves finer than a human hair. Of course, it was totally unworkable, almost the same problem as the doll. It just wore out, and the reproducer would skip. If the spring would chug, as you know, if it unwound unevenly, that would cause the reproducer to skip. And it was totally fragile. And also, being it was recorded acoustically and played back acoustically, the volume was greatly reduced. At the end, they were advertising them as background music or dinner music rather than something you heard like an ordinary record. Here's the last product of their record works, the 78, the needle cut, the 10-inch version with its jacket, produced about 4 months in 1929 before the company went out of the business. Next, please. And the very rare operatic series, the 47,000 series. Ray let me photograph an unmounted label that he had. The records are extremely rare because so very few were produced just in the very last couple months of production. And this is an example of the plated master. Fortunately, all, as far as we're able to tell, all the plated masters of the Edison diamond disc output, needle cut output, long play output, experimental output, survive today at the Ford Museum in Dearborn. They're all lined up in the main vault underneath the building. If you've ever been to the Ford Museum, you know how big that main building is. So a huge vault, about as long as a football field. They're all there waiting to be produced. Not all it takes, but it looks like a copy of every one. 10961 is the pump song by Billy Jones and Ernie Hare, still waiting to be pressed. The other one is the very last disc ever produced, needle cut, in October 19th, 1929. Margaret Becker, I believe, did it, special for Art. What is that? Little Gray Home in the West. You're the very last one, so from the beginning to the end, it's all there, just waiting to be produced. Who knows, though, how much it would cost to produce a diamond disc today, or just any contemporary pressing from one of these masters. But they're all there, waiting for us, if you have a lot of money. Maybe. Okay. Just a few brief pictures here at the end of how the records were packaged. This is the first record jacket for popular series, very drab thing indeed compared to the boxes that were used for the operatic series. Then the operatic series came out in a white jacket after 1913. Next, please. Again, the popular came out in a similar jacket. With a warning label about how to keep from defacing your diamond discs, like don't play them on a Victrola, that type of thing. Next, please. Then strangely, a good old Edison doing strange, stopped putting holes in the middle of the record jackets, making the labels doubly inaccessible. And this continued from 1915 about down to around 1921 when paper labels came out again. Yeah, you'll notice on this one the record liner is the bottom, but you had to make a diagonal cut here to get it to the file drawer, so you lost part of the record level. You'll see they changed it and put the label on top. Yes, Nishkian's a big dealer over in Fresno, very very big Edison dealer for many years there.
What period did they put the catalog number around?
From the very beginning down to around 1918, late 1918. And they took that away, by the way, because they found that was one of the reasons moisture got into the record and caused the rim splits. So they did away with that and then put the number right on the record itself. Yes. There was a brief period when they didn't put any number on it at all. Edison at work again. anyway, the label at the top of the record. And these make for interesting reading if you have them. They do tell you interesting sidelights about the records. It's a nice thing that Edison did, which I don't think was done very much by any other record company with these liner notes until more modern times. Again, here they figured out we better tell the people where to make the cut, so they did put a dotted line so you could file it in the cabinet and put this up here. And these changed the color of the paper, and also the weight of the paper kept getting thinner and thinner as the years went by. The first ones are very heavy cardboard, good stock, and these become paper thin toward the end. Next, please. Finally, they did away with the overlay paper liner notes and began putting the liner notes directly printed on the surface of the jacket. Again, the jacket beginning to get thinner and thinner. Next, please. This is one of the most elaborate ones in the paper label type jackets. I haven't seen too many copies of this. This was done around 1921. Very pretty, stylish type jacket. Again, in the recreation era, 1921-22. And then finally, the jacket that you've probably all seen the most of is this design, which continued down until 1929, and then was redesigned with Edison disc record after 1922. Next, please. And then this is the final type that was used. Again, here's a great hit, Aggravatin' Papa, and it was a fast seller. It wasn't a slow seller, but they got the Red Star anyway. Next, please. And the needle cut jacket. Next. And then we have the back of the diamond disc LP jacket. Again, one of the most elaborate of the late type jackets. Next. That's it. Any other questions? Be glad to answer them. What was the surface? A condensite varnish was the surface of the disc. Below that was the wood core, or later a China clay core filler.
Okay, everybody is rushing off to lunch, and since they'll be closing down at 1 o'clock for lunch anyway, we will start here as promptly after 1 o'clock as we possibly can. We're 20 minutes behind now, but they'll kick you out at 1 o'clock anyway over at lunch.